Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and happy Columbus Day. And because it is Columbus Day, we thought it only fitting to talk about Columbus. So let's start with a few facts.
Of course, he was an explorer, colonizer, and navigator from Genoa. And of course, he didn't actually discover America, but he did complete four voyages across the Atlantic that led to general European awareness of the American continents.
And he had an audacious plan to reach the East Indies by sailing westward across the Atlantic. And in 1492, he landed in what we know today as the Bahamas, believing it then to be the eastern shore of Asia.
Those are some of the facts. There are also some popular ideas about Columbus, among them that he was a greedy conquistador whose desire for gold fueled his passion for exploration.
And lately, it seems Columbus is blamed for a lot of what went wrong in the New World, from greed to smallpox to genocide.
But Carol Delaney has a radically different view of Columbus. She says Columbus was a man of deep passion, patience, and religious conviction. Delaney is a graduate of Boston University and Harvard Divinity School and a research scholar at Brown University. We spoke to her back in 2011 about her book Columbus and the Quest for Jerusalem. And she told us first what inspired her to write about Columbus.
Well, first, as you know, I'm an anthropologist, and I was not a historian. He was not even on my radar until 1999 when I was teaching a course at Stanford, where I was a professor. And I came across, it was called Millennial Fever, and I came across in one of the readings a reference to Columbus's apocalyptic millennial beliefs. I'd never heard about that aspect of his personality, and anyone I asked, nobody knew either. Hmm. So that was the beginning of my quest.
So the quest, and this led you to an understanding of him that he was deeply religious, and this religious passion that he had was very much the driving force of his desire to explore the New World. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, I will. His intention was, as we know, to reach Asia. And there he was expecting to meet the Grand Khan and set up a trading post to trade for gold and spices and so forth. And everybody knows that he was out for gold, but they don't know what it was supposed to be used for.
I guess the assumption was, like anyone, he wanted to be rich, but not so.
I don't think that's true. I think what he wanted, and he stated it in many places in his writings, that he wanted to use the gold to finance a crusade to take Jerusalem back from the Muslims before the end of the world. And at the time, it was a very apocalyptic time because of lots of things that had happened, the plague, the fall of Constantinople, and a few other things. And people really thought the end was imminent. But before the end, several conditions had to be met, and they all knew about that, and read Revelations. First, Jerusalem, everybody had to be evangelized, so they wouldn't burn in hell, because there was a papal bull that there was no salvation outside of the church.
Hmm.
So they were trying to evangelize to get everybody to convert so they wouldn't burn in hell. The second thing, Jerusalem had to be back in Christian hands so the temple could be rebuilt, because that's where Christ was supposed to come back in judgment before the end. And in two places that we know of in his writings, Columbus actually calculated the number of years left before the end of the world.
I found this fascinating in your book. I mean, this major calculation that he did, how did he do that? How did he figure out how many years left before the apocalypse?
Well, first of all, we have to realize that at that period of time, people thought there were only 7 millennia to the world's existence. Mm. And so you had to figure out how many years had passed since creation. And people still today, believe it or not, do the same thing that Columbus did, which was using the biblical genealogies in Genesis. So starting with Adam, how many years did Adam live? And then Seth, how many years did he live? And he went all the way through to the destruction of the Second Temple.
Hmm. And why, in understanding Columbus, is it important to understand this religious motivation? How does it change the way we think about him?
I think, as you said earlier, he's been blamed for everything that went wrong in the New World in these recent years. And I think he's been blamed for the consequences rather than the motivations and the intentions, which that was never his intention.
Mm.
And I think what we need to do is shift our attention to these apocalyptic ideas, which have resurfaced in recent years. And in my sense, I think it could be a self-fulfilling prophecy until we can diffuse this myth.
Hmm.
Many people still believe it, that the apocalypse is coming. There's talk of crusades. People are talking about the apocalypse. And I think it's a very dangerous myth. We live in a very different time than Columbus did.
Sure. So you were really trying to place him in a sort of cultural context.
Absolutely. I'm an anthropologist.
Right.
You know, and rather than looking at him from present day values and beliefs, people have collapsed all the things that happened and did go wrong. But the other thing is that people don't seem to realize is this whole business of slavery. First of all, people in the Caribbean were enslaving and killing each other before he even got there. That seems to have been, you know, disappeared. And secondly, he made very big distinction. On the first voyage, he liked the people very much. They were very friendly. And when he, I don't know if you know that the Santa Maria went aground, and he had to leave 39 men behind. The Nina had already taken off. And he left written instructions, which we still have. Do not abuse the people. These people have been so friendly. They'll take care of you. Do not go raping the women. Do not kidnap. Do not steal their goods. And, of course, the men that he left did all of those things. And when he returned, they were all dead. They had been killed because of all these horrible things. He continually complains about the marauding that his men are doing, and he's often on the ship. And, of course, when that first business happened, he wasn't even there. And again, later on, when he encountered what the natives were calling Caribs, that's not the term he gave, but they said cannibal, Carib. I mean, and those were the ones who were apparently maybe committing cannibalism. They were also practicing sodomy and other unnatural rites. And there is a papal bull that says you may enslave people who are doing these unnatural things.
I see.
So he made big distinctions between the people that he encountered. The ones that he encountered in the beginning were very friendly, very intelligent. He took six of them back to Spain. They became dons. They were not slaves. Everybody seems to think that they were taken back as slaves. They were not. One became, the king and queen were their godparents. Columbus was godparent to one of them, and he came back and forth and interpreted for him.
There was details, though, in your book that I wanted to ask you about. When he finally gets the money from Queen Isabella of Spain to go on his voyage, he asked for some pretty expensive conditions. He wanted to be called a don. He wanted the title of Admiral of the Ocean Sea and Viceroy and Governor of the island and the mainlands that he might discover. So doesn't that sort of support this view that he was a man driven by personal ambition and a quest for riches?
I think he had already proposed the voyage once to King João of Portugal and was denied. And I think he wanted to up the conditions that he would accept. And they were outrageous. On the other hand, there were other people that he talked about who had been given the title of Admiral of the Ocean Sea and hadn't done anything nearly what he was proposing to do, and then eventually did. So, and he also had two sons to take care of. You know, his first wife died. He had a son to take care of, and then he had another son. So
I wanted to ask you about some of the biggest fears and challenges that faced sailors in the 15th century. And I'm asking this because I read that part of your research involved going to sea in a tall ship. So what did you learn, and how did that help sort of fill out your portrait of Columbus?
Well, first I had seen some of the replicas of these wooden ships that he sailed in, and there are no direct plans of those particular ships, but they are so small, they are so high. There's no insulation between the wood, the slats of the wood, you know, no inner wall or anything. And they were, you know, very dangerous. And I think to go out sailing across the ocean sea that nobody had ever done before, where people thought they were monsters or they'd fall off the edge of the world, he didn't believe any of that. But I think some of the sailors did. And when they started out, actually, when they were passing the Canaries, there was a volcano explosion. Many of them got scared about that. They thought it was a very bad omen.
It's also just on the most basic level. I mean, he figured out that he had to sail south to get the right winds behind him to head west, but there was no guarantee that he'd be able to get those winds to help him home without sort of beating against the wind, right? And then he might not have enough provisions to do that.
Actually, that's not the case, because he had already sailed north for some Genoese merchants who were living in Seville.
I see.
And he had been as far as Iceland. And
so
he had already felt the currents that were coming back and the winds. And so he knew long before he was planning to go that if he could ever get across, he could definitely come back.
I see, that the winds would be able to pull him back. Interesting, or push him back.
And he'd already felt the currents going across when he'd gone down the coast of Africa with the Portuguese. And so passing the Canaries, the winds and the currents, definitely. And that's the way sailors who still go across the ocean still go.
Mm. Now, did you conclude this project admiring Columbus as a person?
Yes.
Yeah, you did.
I did.
Liking him.
I do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And say more about that.
I had read all these horrible things. You know, I came at this cold. I had nothing to, no agenda, no hidden agenda. And I read all of these things and letters to his son, all of the documents that we have, which are numerous, and his concern for his men. Mm. He kept writing to the sovereigns, why aren't you paying my men? Mm. They've done these, you know, very dangerous things. They've risked their lives. You're not paying them. The letters to his son are very sweet. He provided for his mistress, with whom he had the second child, in a day when, you know, that was not very common. And well, that really helped change my opinion of him as well.
That was Carol Delaney, an anthropologist and research scholar at Brown University. We spoke to her back in 2011 about her book Columbus and the Quest for Jerusalem.
Well, stay with us. When we come back, we'll talk to two new MacArthur geniuses, poet Ellen Voigt and economist Heidi Williams. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.